So good evening, Bodhisattvas. Hope everybody had a good day. So I want to talk tonight about the Seamless Tomb Koan. Sorry to jump the gun, but we can talk some more about it during the Koan seminar tonight, tomorrow night if you want to. What should I do after you die? Each of us probably imagines a little differently the circumstances that provoke the circumstance that provokes the emperor's question, but its general contours seem clear and clearly part of Chan and Zen terrain. You will lose everything you love, I remember Joan saying in 1998 or 1999, as we sat around a bonfire at a retreat a little north of Phoenix, where I met Jen, in one of those peculiarly open-source evening Dharma talk campfire stories, and everything that loves you will lose you. I want to sneak up on the Seamless Tomb Koan by reading then telling a couple distinct but related stories. The koan itself doesn't seem necessarily too hard to bear. I don't think the national teacher is drawing his last breath. But the story I'll read might possibly be, depending on your recent experiences with death. So hereby a trigger warning of sorts. If the passage upsets you, I apologize, and if you feel like you want to leave the hall, please do so. In our family, we lost our beloved dog a few weeks ago at an old age and after a long illness, and that's one reason the Koan's been on my mind. But I think losing a pet is usually less complexly charged than losing a person, though it's very deep, and I haven't experienced the death of a person I'm really close to in quite some time. So again, I'm sorry if parts of tonight's talk upset you. The passage from The Education of Henry Adams is certainly powerful and startling. It concerns the death of his sister. Here is throughout The Education, which is an autobiography, the author talks about himself in the third person, and it's a really long quotation, so here we go. He had been some weeks in London when he received a telegram from his brother-in-law at the Bagni di Luca, telling him that his sister had been thrown from a cab and injured, and that he had better come on. He started that night and reached the Bagni di Luca on the second day. Tetanus had already set in. The last lesson, the sum and term of education, began then. He had passed through 30 years of rather varied experience without having once felt the shell of custom broken. He had never seen nature, only her surface, the sugar coating that she shows to youth. Flung suddenly in his face, with the harsh brutality of chance, the terror of the blow stayed by him thenceforth for life, until repetition made it more than the will could struggle with, more than he could call on himself to bear. He found his sister, a woman of 40, as gay and brilliant in the terrors of lockjaw as she had been in the careless fun of 1859, lying in bed in consequence of a miserable cab accident that had bruised her foot. Hour by hour, the muscles grew rigid while the mind remained bright until after 10 days of fiendish torture, she died in convulsion. One had heard and read a great deal about death, and even seen a little of it, and knew by heart the thousand commonplaces of religion and poetry which seem to deaden one's senses and veil the horror. Society, being immortal, could put on immortality at will. Adams, being mortal, felt only the mortality. Death took features altogether new to him in these rich and sensuous surroundings. Nature enjoyed it, played with it. The horror added to her charm. She liked the torture and smothered her victim with caresses. Never had one seen her so winning. The hot Italian summer brooded outside over the marketplace and the picturesque peasants, and in the singular color of the Tuscan atmosphere, the hills and vineyards of the Apennines seemed bursting with midsummer blood. The sick room itself glowed with the Italian joy of life. Friends filled it. No harsh northern lights pierced the soft shadows. Even the dying woman shared the sense of the Italian summer, the soft velvet air, the humor, the courage, the sensual fullness of nature and man. She faced death, as women mostly do, bravely and even gaily, racked slowly to unconsciousness, but yielding only to violence as a soldier sabered in battle. For many thousands of years, on these hills and plains, nature had gone on sabering men and women with the same air of sensual pleasure. Impressions like these are not reasoned or cataloged in the mind. They are felt as part of violent emotion, and the mind that feels them is a different one from that which reasons. It is thought of a different power and a different person. The first serious consciousness of nature's gesture, her attitude towards life, took form then as a phantasm, a nightmare, an insanity of force. For the first time, the stage scenery of the senses collapsed. The human mind felt itself stripped naked, vibrating in a void of shapeless energies with resistless mass, colliding, crushing, wasting, and destroying what these same energies had created and labored from eternity to perfect. One thing I find startling and hard to bear about this amazing passage is, as the Zen folks sometimes say, the rendered sense of no gap. The force and profusion and, in this context, unbearable beauty of the world is more than Adams believes he can stand. New life bursts forth, as it always does, inexorably, extravagantly, gorgeously. And while the burgeoning clearly pulls on him, it also seems to him like a horror, a trick, a malevolent joke even. And who can blame him, given the soul-crushing particulars? It seems tactless even to ask whether a slightly different response might have been possible. Instead, I'll shift to pretty different circumstances, a small and not very dramatic story that comes back to me pretty often. It's not particularly intimate or personal, which is part of the difference. A few years ago, I came into work to learn that there had been a terrible accident a couple hours before I got there. An elevator had slipped its pulley while being repaired and pinned the repairman, who'd been straddling the threshold between the elevator's bottom and the outside floor. A colleague I knew had stayed with him and tried to comfort him till the emergency responders arrived. She didn't know if he died later, but thought he might well have. I wasn't grief-stricken, but I was shaken. Later that afternoon, riding up the steep hills toward the mountains to pick up my kids from school, I had a kind of tiny Adams moment. It was spring, and the desert foliage, mesquites and Palo Verdes and creosote, were palpably thriving, though not yet bursting into bloom. No gap. I thought the repairman might have died, and it was as if he'd gone under, as if down in the ocean with hardly a tiny blip, the waves rolling on unconscious, barely deflected. That's how the trees seemed, and the mountains and sky. Unruffled, untroubled, complete. Nothing missing, no gap. The world had completely reconstituted itself. And the sense of evanescence, here then gone, just like that, comported oddly with the sense of the vastness and stillness, the eternal quality of the scene. A moment held in and by and as eternity, like every other moment, if you pause to notice. The stillness welling up through what moved and shifted, making it also feel still. Maybe because I really didn't know if the man had died, and maybe because the loss, if there had been one, wasn't a personal one, this no-gap quality, this nothing missing, felt both chastening, kind of terrifying even, and calm, sustaining. Holding me, abiding me, and letting me, for now, abide. Emperor Su Zhang asked the national teacher, Zhang, what should I do after you die? Build a seamless tomb for me. What should the tomb's design be? There was a long silence, and then the national teacher asked, do you understand? I didn't ask the emperor's question in my version of the koan, where I get to be the emperor, because the national teacher is on his deathbed. But it's not an idle query. Maybe he's ill, maybe gravely, maybe not, or maybe he's just getting seriously old. I ask him what the tomb's design should be, and we sit there in silence together. I imagine a landscape with some vista, pastoral, that we can gaze out and down into, seeing into the landscape. And it's pretty poignant, because he's inviting me to see the terrain that will be there after his death, and to imagine sitting here after he's gone. And so he's gone, and I'm sitting here. What Zen? David Chadwick asked Suzuki Roshi. Everything changes, Suzuki said. One thing we can be sure of is we'll lose everything we love, and everything we love will lose us. Impermanence, Katagiri Roshi said, makes us very quiet. So the stillness and vastness come up through the landscape and through us, and they're here, whether we're here or not, holding the moment we're here and alive, and the time when we're not, in something eternal, in that timeless suspension, palpable, in which all moments are co-present. We're alive and we're dead, Norman Fisher writes. We think we're alive now and we'll be dead later, but that's baloney. Actually, in each moment, we're alive and we're dead. We don't know that, and that's why we're suffering. I think, on reflection, and after talking about it with Bill a few days ago, that Norman probably means something different in saying that than what I have in mind. But I always associate this passage from Norman's work with what I'm trying to with what I'm hoping to evoke here. In this moment that's both evanescent and eternal, that holds all moments in its vast stillness, seen and felt from that vantage, we're alive and we're dead right now. The last retreat Joan taught was in summer 2013, way up in the mountains at Vallecitos Ranch. I was getting ready to have heart surgery, excellent survival rate and very good prognosis, mortality light, as I joked to someone. But Joan was very sick and has continued to be. She won't teach again. The final morning, she held a leave-taking ceremony in the hall, which involved the same beautiful rigmarole I performed last night. Joan walked from place to place as we sat on our cushions, blessing each of us in turn with water shaken from a bough she carried. I'd seen her do the ceremony several times. This time it was unbearably beautiful and heartbreaking. A little later, after the retreat was over, though she was very tired, she invited me to come sit with her on the back porch of her cabin for a little while. It wasn't heart-wrenching the way the ceremony had been. It was full and oddly simple and quiet. We talked a little about this and that and sat in silence some. A bird came by and sat in some nearby branches. The same one, she said, she'd watched with pleasure as it came every day during the retreat. I'd seen the same kind of bird outside my cabin often, I said, and had also felt drawn to it. Ellie came in to help Joan start closing up shop. Was there anything else, Joan asked? Were we done? Nothing else, I said. When we finally had to put our dog to sleep in January, Linda's dog more than mine, this one, incredibly brave and tenacious and wonderful, everything felt bleak and vacant and also full and complete. That's how it's always felt when the cats and dogs I've loved have died. There was a kind of contempt in the landscape felt by him who has just lost by death a dear friend, Ralph Waldo Emerson writes, with a peculiar mordancy, though he's also being tender. The sky is less grand as it shuts down over less worth in the population. The loss is wrenching and it drains the world. And at the same time, that's not true. The world is still complete and burgeoning and perfect. Nothing missing. No gap. The relation between these two feelings, for me anyway, is complicated. If there were only the sense of no gap, of nothing missing or incomplete, of nothing wrong, it would be inhuman. Though the world is full, if that's all I saw or felt, I would be inhuman too, cold, remote. Here's Wallace Stevens in the late poem, This Solitude of Cataracts, imagining this inhuman vantage. He wanted his heart to stop beating and his mind to rest in a permanent realization, without any wild ducks or mountains that were not mountains, just to know how it would be, just to know how it would feel, released from destruction, to be a bronze man breathing under archaic lapis, without the oscillations of planetary pass-pass, breathing his bronzen breath at the azurey center of time. But what if you feel that stillness, that not destroyed, but don't feel it has to be the whole story? Chicago ain't the whole punkin', Apovich, Ezra Pound records some character saying in the cantos. Feeling that timeless completion, no gap and nothing missing, maybe surprisingly, allows me to fall into time and loss and heartbreak more fully, and with a sense that none of it is a mistake. I thought the point of Zen was to let me feel things less, a new student who ended up being Joan's assistant and dear friend said at her first retreat with us, which she sat right after her dog died. But now I see the point is to let me feel them more. Here's a Chan story Joan loves. In a koan from the Book of Serenity, she writes, the Chan teacher Dongshan is dying, and a monastic asks him, "You're unwell. Is there someone, after all, who isn't sick? Is there an aspect of you unaffected by illness? Is there some eternal Buddha nature part of you that isn't experiencing the sickness you're experiencing?" Dongshan says, "There is." Still quoting from Chan. So the monastic asks, "Does the one who isn't sick take care of you?" That's a natural way to think about it. If there's something we believe in, like Buddha nature or God or goddess or whatever we identify as that which is not sick, do we find consolation or comfort there? Are we being taken care of by the not sickness of the universe? But Dongshan says the opposite. "I'm actually taking care of that one. By being sick, I'm taking care of that one who is not sick. In other words, the life I've been given is shaped like this right now. Even when it's hard, it's an extraordinary gift, the vastness swirling into form to experience itself like this, like me. And in exchange, I'm living my life as generously as I can." That's the end of that passage. When Henry Adams' sister dies, when the workman is maimed or killed, when Joan is ill and won't teach again, when the animals and people we love so much die, the vastness goes on being the vastness, and the stillness and silence hold us. Not because they're sad for us, but because that's what they do, because that's what they are. And that sustains us, but it doesn't exempt us or give us refuge from. It gives us refuge in. It's pretty common, though it's not the only response, for people to describe their experience of the vastness, the Dharmakaya, as filling them with overwhelming joy and tremendous gratitude. The radiance often seems flowing and viscous. You can feel it buoying you up, an ocean of air and light. But it doesn't seem to hold you yourself in any particular regard. The vastness isn't the special protector of particular creatures or things. It isn't the faithful guardian of Tenny as Tenny. If you're bathed in something that feels like love, another common description of these moments, it doesn't laser in on you because it thinks you're special. It feels boundless, universal. So to accent Joan's Dongshan story just a little bit differently, the vastness doesn't care. It can't, it's not supposed to, that's not its job. That's our job, to care, to let our hearts be broken. And because the vastness is there, because we feel it holding us, we can do that and let ourselves fall. "What's this?" an old Chan teacher used to ask. The response, it turns out, is just a bow, a full prostration in praise and blessing. Thank you. So it's our American tradition to have a talk about the talk if we want to, rather than just going back into silence. So I'd welcome any questions, comments, disagreements. stories, if you have any.
I guess I wanted to ask about Joan, because I don't really know what's going on, but...
Yeah, I guess what the thing to say is just that she's chronically ill and not likely to get too much better. Oh, you know, that's, I think it's very definite that she won't return to teaching, though Connie just told me she's still writing, which is quite wonderful, though not as much as she used to. And when the senseis visited her in California in September, I think it was, she said she was working on a piece about Trump and America, kind of, you know. And I guess from what Connie said, it's now, it's either out publicly or it's been sent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay,
yeah. So I think it's coming out in either Buddha Dharma or Lion's Roar. I can't remember which, but I think it's going to be a really important piece for us, and that we'll want to talk about it when it's available.
I saw it right before we came into retreat, and I'll find it and share it to the Facebook page.
Thank you. That's great.
People can find it.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. I don't remember exactly the phrase, but it was about... the shape, this is the shape my life is taking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's just a, it's very much like an idea that helps me a lot, that I sometimes come to when I'm struggling, sort of fighting against how my body is working or not working. And it's just very freeing, and it's sometimes hard for other people to relate to, because if they see me having a problem, a physical problem, they sort of need that to be a problem, you know, that I'm fight that and
yeah.
You'll change it. But for me to feel that this is the shape that my life is in now, then I can just fully live that.
Yeah, thank you. My sense is that she's done that in a pretty amazing way for decades now, in one way or another, and not without a lot of work, I think. I don't know what other people think, but...
Joan, you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I remember her talking about making a decision not to be the sick girl.
Yeah.
I'm going to be the sick girl.
Yeah.
And that had to be, that was a conscious choice at that point. And that was, I'm assuming, a long time ago.
Yeah, I think so.
Because
yeah.
She's had some of this, I don't know, specifics for a long time.
I don't know what you thought that meant, but I thought it meant both what Suzanne was saying,
yes.
You know,
yes.
That her situation was her situation,
mm-hmm.
And that she wasn't going to, any more than any other kind of, you know, this is who I am, and sort of stick to that she wasn't going to make that, you know, that explains everything, and that's who I am.
The limit of that story.
Yeah, that's right. Anything else?
Thank you for that concept of no gap, because I think that is very helpful to me. Like when I was feeling that when I lost my husband, that it was like, where did the energy go, you know? And just that concept of how the vastness just goes on, and there is no gap. That energy is so assimilated that you can't identify it, but it's not that it's gone.
Yeah.
It's just not identified at all.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
That
yeah.
concept.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that came up for me with the question of what are you going to do when I'm gone, or however, whether it's
yeah.
which
yeah.
way it is. I was thinking about how the relationship with the teacher and with loved ones, but I'll start with the teacher, where you have this darshan, this grace, this love, and the kind of graciousness of saying, this is probably going to be hard for you, my student, you know, or you know, my wife or my husband or whoever we're talking to, but that in a sense there's a vulnerability there of being a hungry ghost for that that grace. I don't know exactly how to phrase that, but that question is really good, is what are you going to do? And that the loss of that can just knock you out of your dharma, your anything. And just, I guess, I got more of a sense of the national teacher, that the graciousness
yeah.
of that question.
That's really beautiful, yeah, thank you. If I understand the hungry ghost part of what you're saying, you know, all you demons and hungry ghosts whose desire is never satisfied, that in a way the national teacher is saying, I will be in some kind of weirdly projected way, I'll be a hungry ghost for you when I'm gone. Something like that. And by saying it now, allowing something to happen and heal about that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what you meant or not.
I was thinking of it almost more as a warning, in a sense. Just be aware that you can hunger for that love and that grace and get caught there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's great. Warning, it seems like a really good word to me, and it also makes me want to say something else, which is that to me the moment feels incredibly soft when he's sitting there with the teacher. So if it's a warning, it's also, let's sit here, and the thing that heals that is right here.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yes.
Sort of a lament.
Yeah.
What did you say, John?
Yeah.
I said sort of a lament.
And in the context of the afternoon reading. So
took that reading and just in a beautiful way.
Yeah.
Made it much richer. And the word that has stayed with me from that reading is unsayable.
I had a feeling that they would resonate, and the Rilke is really funny for me because you know, we said it so many times at so many retreats over the years, and for a long time I felt Rilke is really strange, you know, because I'm really used to reading poetry, but for a long time I felt I have no idea what this is about at all, and it wasn't exactly like it's difficult, like obscure, like poetry can be obscure, but I just had no experience of what he might be trying to evoke, you know. It was like Mars or something, you know. And then I went through a period for a year or two at this retreat store. I thought, I really loved the days we would do it, and a lot of it spoke to me and made me want to weep and stuff, you know. And then about 2 years later, it got completely opaque for me again. I said, I don't, you know. It's sort of, and thinking about the stuff I was thinking about for this talk when we read it this afternoon, not all of it, you know, but a lot of it, it's like, oh yeah, you know. And the feeling in it is so full and so large and so tender at the same time, yeah. And then I still have those moments in it where I say, I don't understand that.
I remember being in when we would do it in a retreat, just feeling like I was whirling in something that beautiful language, images that would grab you.
Yeah.
But it was unsayable. I couldn't.
Yeah.
You know, it was and it was, you know, much bigger and mysterious in a way that I just couldn't.
Yeah.
Today when we read it, it felt not, I wouldn't say understandable or I think I trusted something about it way back when, though, that there was something so powerful. And today, somehow, and it might have been because of our conversation yesterday, I felt more, the word's grounded, but something, there was some weight to it that, in a good way and in a hard way, you know, you're holding both those things, and you just told, you know, you just carried that further.
Thank you. I mean, it seems to me that there's something really important in Zen practice about the relation between that kind of the experience of the vastness that, you know, John says, oh, without the Dharmakaya, there's no Zen, you know, so in some way it's about that. And then the extent to which that just, if it works right, it just pulls us right back into everything that we thought it might have exempted us from, you know, with more tenderness and acceptance.
And vibrance.
Yeah. And I think also there's something, you know, so Rilke sort of, somehow it's something about the peculiarity of human language, you know, and so, you know, how that sort of holds them both. And certainly that's true of a lot of poetry. And I think the Coens are like that too, that in some way the Coens, in being about the unsayable, It's not just that they're about, you know, that Dharmakaya moment of radiance and light, but somehow that turn toward tenderness and loss is also in some way unsayable, and the Coens can make it live for us, you know, something like that. Thank you.
I would like to see a written version of that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to show you.
There was a lot to take in.
Oh, thank you. So one thing that I didn't, I mean, obviously there's so many different ways to look at the koan, and you know, there's plenty to talk about if we want to talk about it tomorrow night at the koan seminar along with the other ones, but I didn't touch at all on the poem and Shwedo's comments to it, which are on the koan handout, and those are pretty surprising and strange and wonderful sometimes. So, you know, we can certainly circle back to the koan tomorrow night. If we want to.
Did he say those? How did that?
The deal there. I'm blanking on the name of the second teacher. Do you remember? He sends them to the. You know, I have this dharma heir. You know, and so the usually in the Blue Cliff Record, Shwedo, who's the compiler of the Blue Cliff Record, writes a poem on the case the same way Wuman writes a poem on the case. In the Gateless Gate. And in this one, it's funny because the poem is by the teacher that the emperor gets sent to, and then the interlinear remarks after each line are Shwedo.
Tan Yuan.
Tan Yuan, okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So we can talk about that some more tomorrow night if we'd like. Anything else? Thank you very much.